Hello and welcome to the wonderful talk, History of the Mainframe, where we'll learn something about, I'd say, old and current hardware. And we have the wonderful, I forgot the names, sorry, Claudio and
Nico.
Nico, thank you. And I'll just hand over to them and enjoy the talk.
Yeah, hi and welcome to our talk. We're going to lead you a little bit through the history of the mainframe. We're going to start at the S360 and go right back into the current time, Linux. But before we do that, let's first say who we are. My name is Nico. I'm a developer for KVM on S390. I'm also a co-maintainer for KVM unit test on S390.
And hello, my name is Claudio. I am one of the co-maintainers for KVM on S390 and one of the co-maintainers for the KVM unit tests on S390.
Yeah, so first of all, let's answer the question, what is a mainframe exactly? And that term originates from a time where computers were made out of several boxes, so to say. You can say racks today, maybe. There was one box that was the power supply, there was one box that was the tape drive, there was one box that was the hard disk, there was one box that was the actual CPU. And this box that contained the actual CPU, that was the heart of the whole computer, the mainframe. So that's where the term originates from. And at some time, that term became so common that people started to refer to the mainframe as like the computer. So the mainframe designates like a computer architecture that started somewhere in the 60s. And Claudio is going to introduce you what that meant and how that came about.
Yes. So we start in the 50s, late 50s, beginning of the 60s. There were many manufacturers of computers, or different types of computers, big, small, and they were all different and all incompatible. Even the same vendor sold many different lines of systems that were incompatible. Maybe the systems had like some small variations, like you had maybe the same version, like slightly faster, slightly more I/O, a little bit more memory, but it was more or less the same system. And if you wanted to move to a significantly bigger system, then it was a completely different new type of system, different architecture, different instructions, different operating system. Operating systems were written for that specific type of machine, and they were not compatible one with the other. They were very closely modeled after the hardware itself. And the drivers, even for the cases where you had the same hardware attached to different machines, in that case, the drivers needed to be rewritten from scratch. And that meant that moving your software from a specific machine to maybe even a bigger one meant completely rewriting it. Everything was different. The OS interfaces were different. The programming languages even were different, and the machine code. It was a mess, and it was a mess also for vendors themselves, because each vendor had many different lines to cover the spectrum of possible performances that you would want to cover, and they had to support many different incompatible platforms. So also for the vendor side, it was a huge mess. So what happened was that IBM realized that they were not exactly on the leading edge anymore. There was strong competition, and IBM reached to become just a company that sells computers, just like all the others. So a task group was created to address this issue, and the recommendation was to create a line of five compatible systems spanning a 200-fold performance range. And surprisingly, I would say for these times it would be surprising, IBM followed the advice and did what the task group suggested to do, and replaced the whole product line with compatible machines. The whole project was massive and estimated $675 million, which in the 60s was a lot of money, of which 30 million for software. But as things are, the thing went a little bit over budget. It ended up costing 5 billion, which for the time was an even more massive amount of money, of which 500 million just for software. Almost like the whole original budget was just for software, basically. And toward the end of the project, IBM was in financial difficulties. Like, they literally didn't have sometimes the struggle to find the money to pay the salaries, because they were like really, really, really broke. Thankfully, the mainframe worked, and they made a bought a lot of money out of it. Like, but yeah. So that was a moment where they literally bet the company on the mainframe. If the mainframe had not been a success, IBM would not exist anymore. So what came out of this thing? Some innovations. 8-bit bytes. There was no concept of byte at the time. There were characters. They were usually around 6 bits, because with 6 bits you could represent all the letters and numbers and a few more symbols. That was enough for the time. But from the mainframe introduced the concept of 8-bit bytes, the concept of an instruction set architecture. So you have an abstract instruction set architecture, you have your instructions, and then you have the machine implementing the instructions. And you can have a cheap machine, or an expensive machine, a slow machine, or a big machine, and it's the same instructions. You can take your software from the slow machine. If you grow, your company grows and you want to buy a new or rent a new, a more expensive machine, you can just do it and move your software, and it just works. Solid logic technology was at the time an innovation to basically put small standardized components on small printed circuit boards, like some transistors or some resistors, some stuff in a specified configuration. So you would have standardized modules for like XOR or you know whatever kind of thing you wanted. So you could just build your stuff by slotting the standardized things and. Another interesting thing was, again, hardware abstraction in the OS. So how does the S360 architecture look like? First of all, it's a big endian, because at the time was the most logical and obvious thing, because you write from left to right, you big numbers first, right? So 24-bit addresses and a consistent instruction format, 2, 4, or 6 bytes long, and the first 2 bits of the instruction indicate the length of instruction. And this is interesting, because today, the modern mainframes still have the same system. You still have 2, 4, or 6, and the first 2 bits indicate the instruction length. Take note, Intel. registers, 16 32-bit general-purpose registers, which was a lot in the 60s. If you think about the 8086 that came out roughly 10 years after the first mainframe, they had half so many registers and they were half so big. We have one program status word, which is like a mix of program counter and flags, some control flags like interrupt flags, whether we are in supervisor mode, like kernel mode or user space mode, and a few other things. And for 64-bit floating point registers, well, optional because, but.
Also take note that the registers are 32-bit, but the addresses are actually 24-bit. Yes. So that's important later.
Channel I/O is interesting because it's not anything like port I/O or memory mapped I/O, or it's not even like DMA in the most understood sense, because the device cannot just write into memory anywhere. There's a channel controller that is programmed by the operating system, and the device cannot just write in memory. It just communicates with the channel controller, and the channel controller writes in memory where the operating system told them to. So it's kind of like having a DMA with a built-in IOMMU, and that was there in the 60s already. Interrupts, classes and subclasses, protection, floating point, I will cover that in the next slide. Decimal, BCD arithmetic, this is interesting. 8-bit bytes means that you can put 2 base 10 digits in 1 byte, 1 per nibble, and then you can do base 10 arithmetic, for example, for banks or COBOL. That was actually a very new thing at the time, COBOL, so yeah. And then we have what we call DAT, or dynamic address translation, virtual memory on a specific model, and also had multiprocessing with multi-CPUs. So, protection. Paging, there was no virtual memory on most S360s, but there was a mechanism to protect memory, storage keys, each a 2 kilobyte block of memory had an associated 4-bit value plus an optional 5th bit. There was a 4-bit field in the program status word. If that field matches with the storage key of the block of memory, then access is granted, otherwise it's not granted. Optionally, fetch protection, so reading was allowed but not writing, or even reading was not allowed, depending on the fetch protection, if it was set as well or not. And the key zero could do everything, like kind of like kernel mode thing. Why is this interesting to show? Because this is still there today, actually. It's 4 kilobyte blocks now, it's not 2 kilobytes, but this same mechanism, it's still there. Storage keys are still there. Linux doesn't use them, but the hardware has it. So hexadecimal floating point is also interesting. It's, of course, not IEEE compliant, mostly because the IEEE standard came out like 20 years later. So, yeah. And another interesting thing is that the long and short only differ in the size of the fraction. So the range was the same. It's just that the longer one had more precision. And the other interesting thing is that the exponent is not in base 2, but it's in base 16. So it indicated in which nibble the floating point was, not in which bit. No nums, no infinities, and there was some maxable interrupt that could be used to signal if something went wrong, like division by zero, stuff like that. So these are two of the, well, like one of the smallest and one of the biggest models of S260s that came out, and we can see that they had a very different, like a very wide range of performance, from 10 kilo instruction per second to 10 mega instruction per second. So from very slow to, for the time, actually very fast, from 8 kilobyte of memory, which is very low, to 4 megabyte. And interesting is also to see the weight, which was, they were quite heavy. They were almost 1 ton for the small model, and the big model was from 6 to almost 13 tons. And if you wonder why is such a wide variation, that depends on the memory. More memory means you need more of these gigantic steel frames contained in the memory. So more memory means it's actually heavier and bigger, and needs more power. The S360-67 had a virtual memory, some counter registers to handle the virtual memory, a new PSW format because the was needed, 4 kilobyte pages, and a TLB. And we looked at the documentation, actually, and we looked at the documentation went into very, very, very specific details of how the TLB works, how the new entries are formed, and how the old entries are evicted. And it was very, very detailed. And we wondered, why are they putting so much detail into how the TLB works? Well, it had 8 entries. So you needed to write your software carefully to make sure that you wouldn't trash the TLB all the time. So that's why it was so detailed. There was a bunch of operating systems written for the S260. I will cover some of them in the next slides. I will not cover some of them because not so interesting, but there's one I want to mention. It's the TSS360 time sharing system. It's the operating system that IBM wanted people to use for time sharing, like concurrent interactive use of multi-user system. Like most of the other operating systems were like for batch processing, they were not meant for interactive use. And so IBM really put lots of resources into this TSS system, and didn't really work very well. I have read somewhere that like it took 10 minutes to boot, and it would run approximately for 10 minutes before crashing. So I don't know if it's true, but but IBM really pushed that, really wanted that to be successful. So the big OS360 took a lot of time to develop because it was big and complex. So they decided to write a smaller OS to fill the gaps, because they needed to sell hardware and they needed an OS. And so they write smaller operating systems. Then they realized that, oh, wait a second, the big OS is actually too big and cannot run on smaller machines. So So maybe we should actually keep the smaller OSs for the smaller machines. And also, some customers just invested in the smaller OSs and didn't want to switch. So, BPS was actually not an OS, but just a collection of standalone programs that would run directly on a machine, like a compiler or stuff like that. Then there was a basic operating system that would run in 8 kilobytes, so also in the smallest machines. TOS is a tape operating system, if you had tape but not a disk, because disks were expensive. And DOS, the disk operating system, which could run in 16 kilobytes of memory. It was 360, the flagship for S360 mainframes, three variants, all the same API, ABI, and job control language. PCP, a single task could run on 48 kilobytes. MFT, meaning multi-programming with a fixed number of tasks, aka the memory was partitioned in fixed slices and you could run different tasks in different slices. Of course, it was all batch processing, so it was not interactive. And MVT, multi-programming with variable number of tasks, which was big and required a half megabyte of memory, which was actually a lot of memory at the time. They all had file name structures, like the file naming had a structure, so you could have hierarchies and various forms of remote access, except for the PCP, and subtasks, except for the PCP. And actually, the PCP was not even released in the final version of the S360 because it's like you can just use DOS, I guess.
So, yeah. Claudio, what could possibly go wrong if you have an operating system with a variable number of tasks, but no virtual memory?
Memory fragmentation.
Oh.
Yay. So what happened is that memory could get fragmented, and if a program needed more memory, the OS would just figure out which process to literally swap out to disk. So not a page, like the whole process would be swapped out and memory freed for another process, which was... Yeah, I mean, not exactly super nice, but it worked. It worked. So another interesting thing is the Cambridge monitor system, written by the Cambridge IBM lab, as a single user operating system and can run bare metal on S360. And people really liked it. People really liked the single user operating system, but they wanted to have it kind of like multi-users. So they did the logical thing, and they wrote a hypervisor to have basically a virtual machine and run their single-user operating system and inside the virtual machine. But you had multiple virtual machines, so you had a multi-user system, kind of.
Logical,
yeah, of course. The virtual machine was a trap and emulate type of machine, and the first version ran on a specially modified S360-40, which did not have virtual memory, but they literally hacked it. They literally hacked the microcode and the stuff to have it, and it was used as a prototype for the actual CP67, Control Program 67. It was actually used in production, but not supported by IBM. IBM didn't like this stuff. They wanted to push their TSS, remember. They didn't like it, so they never really supported it. They didn't really care too much in the beginning about this. And eventually it became VM370. VM stands for virtual machine. Another interesting thing is the Erlang control program. Real-time, transaction-oriented, not a general-purpose OS, as in you cannot even compile a program on it. You need to cross-compile for it. And it can do lots of transactions. So airlines used it for reservations, and then banks were like, you can do transactions in real-time. So banks started using it, and then IBM was like, maybe you should not call it airline control program. It's more like a transaction processing facility. Yes, that sounds nicer. And it's still there. It still exists now. It's called ZTPF and works on 64-bit architectures. So, 70s, new evolution of the architecture, S370 for the 70s. Visual memory was now part of the base architecture, but it was different than the S360-67, different and incompatible. So you couldn't just take a operating system from the 67 and run it here. It supported both 2 kilobyte and 4 kilobyte page status. There were some other interesting things, like support for multiprocessing was built in. Later on, the architecture was extended with the extended architecture, which had a switchable per process 31-bit mode. Yes, it's not a typo, it's 31. If you wonder why 31, because, we had 32-bit registers. So the highest bit was used to switch between 31-bit and 24-bit for backwards compatibility. At this point, only 4 kilobyte pages were supported for virtual memory and for storage keys. The channel I/O was completely rewritten, and there were also very nice vector instructions, which unfortunately I don't have the time to talk about, but they were very nice, only for that specific model in the beginning. And then ESA370 architecture, with access register mode, which is a crazy thing that can be used to have like up to 256 address spaces at the same time in the same process. It's still there in the architecture. It's quite complex.
And I watched a talk from GPN 2019, in case you're interested what that is and how that works.
I had a talk, and you can just watch the recording from, or ask us later. And the interesting thing is the LPAR logical partitions. You could slice the mainframe in logical partitions that behave like completely separate machines. So you could run like production and testing on the same machine, because they were actually two different partitions and they could not influence each other, and it was stable. And it's still there, by the way. It's in modern mainframes. That was for the S370. So virtualization, at some point, IBM starts to realize that, hey, virtualization maybe is important. So first in 1980, they had a small extension to allow VM to run faster. And then in 84, with the S370XA, the start interpretive execution instruction, which is kind of like the VM start instruction that you have on modern machines, but like on x86 machines, but that was like there in 84 already. And nested paging was supported like out of the box since the beginning, and most instruction executes inside without even an exit, and there's a control block describing the guest CPU, and it's still there today. That's the instruction that like KVM uses on S390 to run virtual machines. So in the beginning were some clones that were more like copying instruction set, not exactly being a drop-in replacement, except for the Soviets that they actually wanted to clone it. And then in the 70s, one guy, former IBMer, Gene Amdahl, formed the Amdahl Corporation and started selling drop-in replacement for IBM mainframes. And some other companies noticed that, and they were like, hey, we can do that too. And so they did. And it's a little bit embarrassing, but at some point, some of the competitors sold better hardware than IBM itself. So this is an overview of the operating system. We can see the DOS on the left, OS/360 that became MVS and then became OS/390 and then became ZOS, which is still there. The control program, which is VM, which is now called ZVM, TPF, and then we have a bunch of Unixes. So the first one is actual Unix, ported with the help of AT&T, working inside TSS, basically using TSS as a supervisor, and the kernel was kind of running as a process inside TSS. And then also in the 80s, Amdahl Corporation, they had a different port of Unix running inside VM instead, so to avoid interacting directly with the hardware, they relied on VM. And that was quite successful, and IBM had to kind of run after them. So it was IX37 and VMIX, which were actually two different pieces of software. One more based on the Unix from above, and one was a different thing. I searched in the documentation, I digged into all the old documentation and announcement. I couldn't really find much information about this. In 1988, AIX370 was released, so again, a proper Unix, and in 1991, AIX ESA, which could finally run bare metal and not necessarily inside VM. And then the whole thing was kind of merged into MVS itself, into the flagship OS. Then Linux happened, and 2001, ZOS Unix System Services. So basically, IBM merged Unix inside ZOS. ZOS is actually POSIX compliant. And interestingly, in 2008, someone ported OpenSolaris for the mainframe, but it was a short-lived effort.
Let's talk about the FV90, the further evolution of the architecture. So we get additional floating point registers, we now have 16 in total. And additionally to the hexadecimal floating point, we now learn the proper IEEE 754 floating point format. So you can do both, whatever you prefer. We also get a few additional instructions to work with immediates, to work with relative addresses. And I think the most mentionable thing is suppression and protection. And we need to look at what suppression and protection actually means. So if we want to talk about Unix, something very important that we need to talk about is the fork system call. And what a fork system call does is, if you have a process and that process executes a fork system call, you get basically a second process that is identical to the first process. And because copying a process basically means that you have to copy the memory, and that would be slow, most operating systems do it, or almost all Unixes do it in the following way. You have the pages of the first process. These are read-write. And then the process executes the fork. And in the forked process, these pages become read-only. And then what happens if the second process, the forked process, tries to write to one of these pages? It tries to write, but the page is read-only. So what happens, an exception is generated, and the operating system can do copy on write. It can copy the page and then perform the write on the copy, so the original contents of the page are not destroyed. And now what is an important thing to have for this to work is that this exception happens when the instruction that caused the exception did not really do something yet. So it must not happen that you do a write and then you, for example, cross a page boundary and then you get the exception just when you cross the page boundary, because that would be bad and would mean that there would already be something written in the previous page. So that's very important for Unix-based operating system. And S390 actually behaved that way. So S390, it could happen that you got the exception, but part of the instruction was already executed. That's not so good. So that makes it very hard to implement fork. So basically what you can say, S390 was not a very good fit for Unix-based operating systems. So in February 1993, IBM realized that and added suppression on protection to the architecture, which basically meant when you get this exception, you're guaranteed that this write has not yet been executed, and a few other things. What is kind of interesting is in 1993, there already was a Unix, right? How did they do that? We don't know how they did it. We assume that they had some internal knowledge on how the machine works exactly inside, so they could kind of work around it a little bit. But yeah, it was probably very hacky, so it's good IBM introduced that.
Yeah, but I know that for a fact that they did do copy and write, because I looked into the documentation, and yes, they were doing copy and write somehow. So,
We don't know. But yeah, the architecture now has support for suppression and protection. We can do proper Unixes on the architecture now. Good, okay, so bipolar versus CMOS. So bipolar and CMOS, these are two technologies, how transistors work, how CPUs are modeled, and mainframes, because they're so old, bipolar was there earlier, they're almost always traditionally based on the bipolar technology. And the bipolar technology that's interesting, and that's very good because it's so fast, you can switch your transistors really, really fast. But it has a striking disadvantage, it's extremely hot. So things run very hot when you use bipolar technology. And IBM really, really had to spend lots of effort to get rid of all the heat. So at my university, we always had a problem that the basement was always very cool. And I remember asking the question, guys, why is it so cool here? Can't you do like the climate one a little bit hotter? And then they told me, no, it's not possible. It's actually already on the lowest level, because the building was built in the 70s and they expected that we could get more bipolar machines. They built like a huge AC into the building, and now we have to always put it on the highest setting and it's still too cool in the building. Yeah, okay, so that was bipolar times. So IBM slowly started realizing we have to spend lots of engineering effort to get rid of all the heat. And in 1994, IBM started digging into the CMOS technology. The CMOS technology allowed the machines to be a bit slower. The transistors could switch up a little bit slower initially, but they were running much cooler. They built a line of machines which was based on the CMOS technology. They removed a few optional features, for example, the vector instructions. And the first CMOS machines, actually have to admit, they were not so nice. They were slow and like prototypey things. But there was some application, but they were really, really were slow. And slowly IBM started evolving the CMOS technology and redesigning the CPUs. We found a paper that they redesigned the CPUs at the time. And CMOS was getting better and better and better. And at some point it was actually better than the bipolar technology, and it didn't have as much hassle with the heat. And with the fifth generation of these CMOS-based machines, sixth generation, they were actually faster than the bipolar machines. And eventually the whole mainframe moved from bipolar to CMOS technology. So one thing is, what actually is interesting about the architecture too, is IBM built machines that had more than 2 gigabytes of RAM end of the 80s. Yet, our addresses were just 31 bits. So you kind of might ask the question, how can you do more than 2 gigabytes of RAM when you only have 32 1-bit addresses? So there are two things. For example, for the address space and the application, Claudio mentioned earlier the access register mode, which basically means that one application does not have one address space. One application can have up to 256 address spaces. So this way, you can have an address space of effectively like half a terabyte for one application, allowing the application to deal with a lot of data. The second point is, how can you actually physically address that memory, more than 2 gigabytes, with only 31-bit addresses? And for that, IBM invented a concept that is called expanded storage. And expanded storage basically means that you can tell the machine, hey, I have this page here in physical memory, please put it in another thing that is almost as fast as my RAM, and then I can just take it back from there. So for a very, very long time, the mainframe was actually able to deal just fine with just 31 bits, and it also meant that you didn't have to do much adjustment to your application, and that's always important to keep compatibility with your applications. But finally, in 2000, it happened, and the mainframe moved to 64 bits. So what IBM basically did, registers were extended to 64 bits. There were new instructions that they could deal with the 64-bit registers. And we still kept the compatibility with 31-bit, in fact, also 24-bit. So you can just run fine 24-bit application, it's not a big problem. Page tables levels were extended, and you can basically say up on this point the clone manufacturers are basically dead, so they could not keep up with the switch to 64 bits.
I would just want to point out that the number of levels of page tables is variable per process.
That's right.
To not have, I mean, to have performance.
Good, so let's take a bit, look a bit at the evolution. And with the C900 in 2000, we get the so-called IFLs. IFLs are special processes that can only run Linux. The idea is basically that if you only want to run Linux on a certain processor, you get that one cheaper. With C990, you get the CAAPs, which are again specialized processors that are meant to run databases and Java applications, also for licensing reasons. In 2005, mainframes, they don't have a BIOS. We have something that is a little bit nicer. We have like a fancy web UI where you can configure your computer, how it's going to boot. And this HMC, we call it HMC, it ran OS 2, and in 2005 we actually finally switched to Linux for that. We got large pages a little bit late to the party, but yeah, we got it.
Better late than never.
In 2010 our process reached a speed of 5.2 gigahertz. Fastest clock speed at the time.
Probably.
With C12 we got transactional memory. With C13, we got vector instructions, again, differently.
Different and incompatible with the previous ones. But
yeah, but we got them now. And we got SMT, so you can run multiple threads in one CPU, and that was mainly also made for Linux. With C14, we stopped supporting 31-bit operating systems, which doesn't mean that you can still run 24-bit applications, just your operating system needs to be 64 bits. And with C15, we get support for secure execution, which basically means running confidential VMs on your mainframe. Good, C16, I always forget that, it's so new. We have neural network assist, which is basically a neural network acceleration. So let's take a look. If you want to port Linux to our architecture, you need a compiler first. And for Linux, that basically means you need GCC. So we first need to answer the question, how did GCC come to the mainframe? And if we dig into this a little bit, we find out that in October 1993, in GCC, code appears for the so-called I370 backend. It was developed outside of IBM by someone who wanted to run applications or wanted to compile applications for the MVS operating system. And it was really basically targeted at that. So you could compile applications for MVS and run it on the mainframe. It was not really meant for operating systems and basically just for that purpose. And then for quite a long time, absolutely nothing happens. In 1999, IBM, IBM wants to replace internally a compiler they used, which was developed at the end of the 80s. They're looking for a C compiler, and they take a look at this I370 backend for GCC. And while analyzing that, they find, yeah, you can actually port GCC and it works on the mainframe. So they take a look at their requirements a little bit and they realize, yeah, but it's not quite that what we need. So they start a new port, the so-called S390 port, which has less backward compatibility, hence also the different name, 390, 370. So they develop a GCC backend for the mainframe. So in 1998, Linux ports to the mainframe start, and this further accelerates the development of the compiler. So for example, we get ELF support in GCC and other features that you need for operating system, for Linux in general. Finally, after quite some time, after the SV90 backend is maintained out of tree, but in 2001, IBM finally upstreams the code and gives it to the Free Software Foundation. And since then, GCC can use the SV90 backend natively in the upstream. Good. Now we have a compiler. Imagine you're employed at IBM, someone in maybe 1998. You have this shiny new operating system, which is called Linux. You might be playing around with it at home a little bit. And you have this nice GCC compiler. So what do you do? Yeah, you basically start prototyping the port of Linux to the mainframe. And that's actually what happened. So in 1998, IBM engineers in their free time basically make a prototype. We can port Linux to the mainframe. And yeah, they show it to people and people seem to like it. And IBM initially makes it an official thing. But they're a little bit hesitant. So on the 18th of December 1999, the source code of the S390 port for Linux is released, but just on IBM's FTP server. It's not like an upstream thing. It's first on IBM's web server, FTP server. You can download it from there. It's just an IBM thing until in January 2000. Just a little bit later, it appears in the release of Linux, of the Linux kernel. So in Linux 2.2.14, Linux actually learns how to run on the mainframe upstream.
That was fast.
That was really fast. So people seemed to kind of like it. It seemed to be interesting for people. And very quickly after that, the first Linux distribution appears, the Marist Linux, which was basically only targeted to the mainframe. And yeah, so then Linux runs on the mainframe. That's basically the story. So I mentioned earlier that were actually ports of Linux to the mainframe. And there were two ports of Linux to the mainframe. There was the S390 port, which was developed by the IBM engineers that, in their free time and then later made an official IBM project. And then there was also the I370 port named after the GCC backend. And this was developed outside of IBM. It was developed by people that did not have access to the newest shiny machines. So the I370 port was also compatible with older boxes. It also used a little bit of a different syntax, so it's more familiar to people that program the mainframe to understand the code, while S390 uses a little bit more different syntax. It also uses a completely different toolchain. The S390 port uses the GCC S390 toolchain, and the I370 port uses the I370 toolchain of GCC. You have to say that i370 was certainly less stable than s390 port. I read online that it could boot and it could spawn a shell as the init process, but then it tried to open the console and it crashed. So you got fire, but it was not very useful. So yeah, but you certainly have to acknowledge by someone who is a volunteer who does it basically outside of IBM, it was actually considerable achievement. Because the S390 was done by IBM employees, yeah, of course. And the i370 port was then later abandoned when the S390 port was published by IBM. Yeah, so that's the story of the two ports of Linux to the mainframe. Good, so the question that I ask, why was this interesting? I mean, this the source code came into the Linux kernel so quickly, and people built Linux distributions for it, and there was general interest on this. Why? And these are the reasons that I found. Maybe there are more, but this is what I found. So first reason that I found is consolidation. So in the 2000s, the data center looked like it was boxes. So you had one box for the web server, you had one box for the database server, you had another box for the mail server, then you had another box for the FTP server and whatnot. You had just an absurd amount of boxes in your data center. And with the mainframe, because the mainframe knows virtualization quite well, and with CVM and Linux, you could basically just put all that boxes on a single mainframe. So it was kind of attractive because this would save space in your mainframe. It would save hassle by running around and replacing hardware all the time. It would save also energy. So this was one reason why people said Linux is interesting, because I can just take CVM and Linux and run all my boxes on the mainframe. Second reason that I found, Java. People really like Java. They wanted to run Java applications. Okay, they did, maybe, I don't know why. And it worked well on Linux, so yeah, it was attractive for people to run Java applications on Linux. Another reason was Unix. So application vendors often said that, yeah, we want a Unix-like OS. And yeah, that was another reason. Yeah, Unix-like OS, why not Linux? Also save costs. I think that was also a very important point. It's a comparatively cheap operating system. Mainframe operating systems are expensive. Later, IBM also introduced, I already mentioned it, cheaper CPUs that could only run Linux, the so-called IFLs. And I think you also have to mention this, it was just cool. I mean, people liked it. They liked Linux, they ran it at home maybe, so they also maybe wanted it on their mainframe. Good, so let's take a little bit look at the evolution of the Linux kernel. In 1999, Linux for S390 is published. In 2001, Linux learns how to run on a 64-bit S390X architecture. That's what we call the 64-bit variant. The 64-bit kernel, of course, can run the 31-bit user space just fine and still do that today. In 2003, the mainframe gets, or Linux gets SCSI support. Up until that point, you had to have a specialized storage for mainframes, so you had to buy a specialized storage box just for your mainframe, which was expensive, and you maybe already had a SCSI storage around somewhere. So since 2003, you can use your SCSI storage with a mainframe. 2008, the Linux kernel learned how to run VMs on the mainframe. So what demonstrates the virtualization capability is at KVM Forum 2008. IBM showed a mainframe or a Linux partition in the mainframe that ran like 200 Linux VMs, which is, I mean, quite a lot. So it shows that the platform can do virtualization quite well. In 2013, the Linux kernel learns how to talk to PCI devices on the mainframe. It's basically a more standard interface to the hardware, like for NVMEs, for network cards, for hardware security modules. But you don't have to believe that you can just take any hardware and plug it into the mainframe. Most of the time, you still need specialized hardware that has some adjustments.
And also, if you're wondering why PCI support came so late, is because, well, mainframes had channel I/O, which was actually quite good, very good. So the PCI was not needed basically until it was, which is still quite late.
So in 2015, IBM releases the Linux One, a specialized system that can only run Linux. The idea basically is that you all again save costs, because with a traditional mainframe you need to have at least one processor that is a non-IFL processor. With Linux One you can run just Linux, and again save a little bit of cost if you intend just to run Linux. 2017, the mainframe gets support for SMC, which is basically a socket-like connection that is in the background a shared memory, works locally and also remotely between mainframes. And in 2020, Linux learns how to run confidential VMs with secure execution. And for secure execution, Claudio has a talk.
Yeah, I mean, secure execution alone is a whole talk, which I have already given, actually, the KVM forum in 2019. So if you're interested, just look that up or talk to us afterwards.
So these are a few references that we have. You can find the documentation, all the manuals, the principles of operations, as we call them, the manual that describes the instructions and the CPUs, some extensions. You can look them up using this numbers, and then you will find the documents. And in case you want to play with it, buy a mainframe.
Yeah, maybe not.
No, not really. Okay, so if you have an application and you want to try it on Big Endian, you can actually use this link, sign up there, and then you will get a Linux VM running on a mainframe. So in case you have something and you want an architecture that's Big Endian, or maybe you like the mainframe, you can just sign up there and you get a VM and you can try software on it and play with it, play with Linux a little bit, in case you enjoy it. And then there's also CPDT, which basically allows you to run COS, but it's also expensive and a product. And there is also QEMU that can emulate newer mainframe hardware. And for all the hardware, there's other emulators you can use, and software. Claudio.
Yeah, well, copyright worked differently in the 70s. And if you did not put a copyright notice in your software or whatever you were publishing, then it was not copyrighted. And IBM didn't bother to protect their operating systems in the beginning, because why? What does, if you get the OS, then you're going to buy a mainframe to run it, right? So who cares? Then the clones started to arrive, and they started to care. So you can still get OS 360 and DOS 360 and TOS 360 for free. They're literally public domain. You can just Google and you find it. And for VM, you can actually get even VM 370 public domain, because IBM didn't care about VM in the beginning, because they were pushing TSS, which you can also find, because didn't really go well. So if you want to play a little bit with these things, you can literally just Google. You will find websites where you can just download an image ready to run in an emulator.
Good. End of file. Any questions?
My question is, how many of your customers are still running non-Linux applications? And are there special features to communicate between Linux and the other operating systems?
I actually don't know how many customers do. There are special features, I think it's called hypersockets, that you can use to communicate between COS instances and Linuxes. And many customers use it to have like a legacy application on COS, and then you have like a fancy Java, Linux, Node, whatever application that talks to your traditional application.
Yeah, but the numbers, like, we don't know. I mean, someone at IBM does know, but not us. It's not us.
I found one point missing on your reason or list of reasons.
There's many things missing in this presentation. Okay. Trust me. We wrote a presentation and we had to throw away like 2/3 of it because. But yeah.
Go ahead.
Customer of mine bought mainframes larger than their mainframe usage, so they had to think about how can we put load on the mainframe that isn't generated by batch processing, and that's the reason why they adopted Linux on the mainframe.
Ah, okay.
The CPU got that faster than the usage that they had reserved they could use cheaper.
OK. Okay, interesting. Interesting detail.
I noticed that the version numbering was a bit weird. Like
yeah,
from
Z990
to Z9 and then up again, and at some point there were other jumps. Is there a reason for that? Like
marketing.
So no. It's just like Apple skipping numbers.
Yeah, actually, if we go back, we can see something interesting. If we go back to the S3, here you see G1, G2, the generation 1, generation 2, G5, G6, and then we jump to Z900 because it sounded cool, and then Z990, but then it's Z9. Why? Because this was G7, this was G8, this is G9, G10. They decided to do something else here, and then we're back on track. So it's marketing. I hope they will stay like this, but it's not in our control.
It's not AppStick. It's just we can't count.
Thanks. First of all, thanks for the talk. IBM has another kind of obscure hardware platform with the Power platform, and I spent a lot of time working with Power, and Power has the neat possibility to run SMT8, so basically 8 threads on one core, which is kind of crazy. So I was puzzled a bit whether this is also available on the mainframe or whether we are talking SMT2 here.
SMT2.
Okay, thanks.